You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Death and the Mask by Joe Pompeo. Bands that emerged at the Mask became the stuff of legend. Belinda Carlisle and her fellow Go-Go's were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2021, celebrated for their well-crafted songs that formed a bridge between the brash urgency of L.A. punk and the dark melodies of new wave pop. That same year, the Screamers received a belated New York Times profile, pegged to the first and only official release after more than four decades of their avant-garde synth-punk. The Germs, whose guitarist Pat Smear broke into the mainstream as a member of Nirvana and the Foo Fighters, were immortalized in Roger Grossman's 2007 biopic, What We Do Is Secret, starring Shane West as doomed singer Darby Crash and Bijou Phillips as celebrated bassist Lorna Doom. Some habitués of The Mask found their own success in film and TV. Penelope Spheeris directed box office hits like Wayne's World and The Little Rascals after chronicling the early days of L.A. punk in her landmark 1981 documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization. Screamers drummer K.K. Barrett became an Academy Award-nominated production designer, known for his work with Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola. Kara Russler, who went on to play bass in Black Flag, made her name as an Emmy Award-winning dialogue editor with credits on The Twilight Saga and Game of Thrones. Fear frontman Lee Ving has an IMDb page that includes appearances in Flashdance, Clue, as the menacing Mr. Body, and an infamous 1981 episode of Saturday Night Live, during which Fear, thanks to a bit of string pulling by John Belushi, wreaked havoc as the evening's musical guest. The Mask unlikely impresario was Brendan Mullen, a skinny Scottish expat who lived at the bottom of the main staircase in a room that doubled as his office. In the coming years, Mullen would give the Red Hot Chili Peppers their first gig, book shows for a pre-fame Guns N' Roses, and help launch the Viper Room with Johnny Depp. For now, at 28, he was simply an affable, music-loving UK transplant who'd stumbled into a career promoting shows. As Mullen wrote in 2007, no big plans to open up a punk palace. No entrepreneurial impulse inspired me to start a business. Only dumb luck compelled me. A former newspaper reporter and a drummer, Mullen had come upon the basement by chance in the spring of 1977 while looking for somewhere to jam without having to worry about neighbors calling the cops. He struck a deal for an $850 monthly lease, cleaned the place up, partitioned off some rooms, and advertised it as a spot for bands to rent rehearsal space. We were literally dead center in the bowels of Hollywood, Mullen later recalled. I agreed to take it as is, thrashed to hell, and got a free month's rent to clear out 15 years of debris. Almost in the blink of an eye, Mullen's humble rehearsal studio transformed into an all-hours playground for the first generation of L.A.'s punk rock and new wave cognoscenti. It was more of a clubhouse than a club or a venue, per se, says Marina Mulfredel, better known as Marina Del Rey, whose band Backstage Pass was among the first to shack up in one of the Mask practice rooms. Mulfredel's salary as an editor at Teen Magazine enabled her to co-sign the lease when Mullen ran into trouble with the landlord. We were all in it together. Another early visitor was the performance artist and Andy Warhol star Bibi Hansen, who frequented the Mask with her father, the Fluxus artist Al Hansen. Bibby could often be found taking photographs of the Controllers, another early mask band, during their rehearsals. She would sometimes bring along her 7-year-old son, a future Grammy Award-winning musician named Beck. "I'm from New York, so I'm used to alternative spaces and dark places," she says, "but for L.A., it was pretty raw." In late August, with the addition of a stage that couldn't have been more than a foot high, Mullen started booking shows. Through the end of summer and into the fall, hundreds of young punk fans and other miscellaneous oddballs packed the mask to see bands like the Dickies and the Zeros, the Avengers and the Bags, the Weirdos and the Eyes and the Alicats. No two bands born or bred at the mask were alike, the L.A. Times' McKenna later recalled, also observing the mix of people was incredibly diverse. Rich kids, poor kids, drug addicts, alcoholic art students. On the surface, nobody had much in common, yet all were unmistakably members of the same tribe. In the popular imagination, late 70s L.A. was a sun-kissed Xanadu of disco and yacht rock. The mask nurtured a dark and irreverent alternative, creating a space where an influential subculture could thrive. It was a heady atmosphere of vice, debauchery, art, rebellion, and the requisite dash of danger. To a punk rocker, recalls Kid Congo Powers, who went from mask regular to guitarist for the Cramps, the Gun Club, and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, few things were more alluring than danger. Danger, indeed, was closing in. An era had dawned that would become known as the Golden Age of Serial Killers, and Los Angeles was on its way to earning the unfortunate designation of Serial Killer Capital of America. The latest serial killings were now unfolding in the hillsides around Hollywood, where the corpses of young women had been turning up with ligature marks around the necks, victims of an anonymous perpetrator dubbed the Hillside Strangler. The 7th identification of a strangler victim came on the evening of Wednesday, November 23rd, as the mask filled up for a show headlined by the Germs. Authorities were able to get an ID on the body using fingerprints and dental charts. As it turned out, she was a familiar face at the mask, a blonde beauty who had celebrated her 28th birthday just a month earlier. She lived in an apartment at 8530 Holloway Drive, West Hollywood, and she'd been reported missing by her roommate on November 12th after failing to return home from an acting class at the Scientology Center on Franklin Avenue. Her name was Jane King. King's body was discovered on the outskirts of Griffith Park, beside an off-ramp of the Golden State Freeway. A cowboy boot-wearing homicide detective named Dudley Varney arrived to inspect the crime scene, determining the body had been thrown or tossed from the area of the roadway. Varney had been appointed to oversee the field investigations of the Cross-Agency Hillside Strangler Task Force, which set out to probe the killings. Yolanda Washington, a 19-year-old sex worker, mother of a 2-year-old daughter, and the sole black woman on a growing list of victims, had been found near Griffith Park on October 16th. The body of Judith Miller, a 15-year-old runaway and former Hollywood High School student, turned up on November 1st in a residential neighborhood in La Crescenta. 21-year-old Lissa Caston, a waitress from North Hollywood, and member of an all-female dance troupe called the L.A. Knockers, was found on a highway embankment near the Chevy Chase Country Club in Glendale on November 6th. Christina Weckler, a 20-year-old honors student at Pasadena's Art Center College of Design, was found dead in Highland Park by a group of hikers on November 20th. Later that same day came the discovery of Dolores Cepeda and Sonia Johnson, just 12 and 14 years old, last seen at the Eagle Rock Plaza shopping center. A 9-year-old boy hunting for treasure in a trash heap near Dodger Stadium happened upon their remains. And then there was King, identified in newspaper reports as a beautiful, aspiring actor and model, sometimes known to accept hitchhiking rides in the Hollywood area. She was trying to break into famous Hollywood. The roommate, who had reported King missing on November 12th, told the L.A. Times, "She was always on the go, running around, always out someplace. She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time." The director of Scientology's Celebrity Center International told the Times King had studied there. She was currently working as a model and was into music, he said. She had a definite interest in acting and had hoped to pursue that line. Overall, he sensed that King was trying to find herself. Born in Arizona on October 20, 1949, King grew up in Arcadia, California, just outside L.A.'s northeast city limits. "She was quiet and shy," says Bill Pauley, a childhood classmate. Cecilia Joder befriended King at Arcadia High School, where they were members of the class of 1967, 1 year behind Stevie Nicks. "We sat next to each other in arts and crafts, and we just had a ball," says Joder. "She was a run-of-the-mill girl like me. I didn't expect her to be running around Hollywood. When I heard that she'd been killed, I was shocked." A brief inscription in one of Joder's high school yearbooks was the only trace of King's voice that I could find. "Cecilia," she wrote, "it was fun this year in psychology and last year in art crafts. Be happy. Love, Jane King." King's younger sister, Judy King, told me about their childhood being raised by a single working mother, Abra King, in Arcadia, where the family lived with Abra's parents. There were vacations at the national parks and at the beaches near San Diego. Occasionally, letters and gifts arrived from the girl's absent father, a ranch hand in New Mexico. After high school, Jane found jobs as a candy striper and a massage therapist. She discovered Scientology, drawn to its promise, as Judy recalls, of helping practitioners remove hindrances that might keep you from being your best self. And she gave birth to a daughter in 1968, fathered by a young man Jane had met while celebrating Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Jane, not yet 20, decided that an adoption was in the baby's best interest. Before saying goodbye, she settled on the name she would have given her, Goldberry, in homage to a character from the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. After Judy graduated high school 2 years behind Jane, she moved to Oregon with a man who lured her into what she described as a cult-like community. Sometime in 1973 or 1974, Jane visited Judy and tried to bring her back home. It was the last time that Judy, who eventually did break away from her communal family, saw or spoke to her sister. "She realized I was being deceived," Judy says. "She was trying to rescue me." Jane's love of rock and roll, especially the Rolling Stones, blossomed in her teenage years, so it made sense later when she began dating a fellow Stones enthusiast named Rick Wilder, who would be described in the L.A. Times as a Mick Jagger, Johnny Rotten clone created by some mad punk scientist. Next photo, screen test. Jane King had Hollywood dreams that she was beginning to realize. Her sister points to this shot from the opening montage of 1977's Looking for Mr. Goodbar. Wilder can't recall exactly when he met King, but it had to have been sometime in the mid-1970s. Back then, Wilder was the singer of the Berlin Brats, once dubbed L.A.'s first homegrown glam rock band. His parents were the opera singers Giovanni Millo and Margarita Girosi. One of his two sisters, April Millo, became a luminary of the Metropolitan Opera. The other, Grace Millo, became a singer-songwriter. They had a peripatetic childhood, traveling around as their parents toured small opera houses and concert halls in Italy and the U.S. When a heart condition forced Giovanni to give up his singing career, the family settled in Los Angeles, where Wilder attended Hollywood High School, Fairfax High School, and the now defunct Hollywood Professional School, whose alumni include John Drew Barrymore, Judy Garland, Melanie Griffith, Val Kilmer, Mickey Rooney, and Natalie Wood. King entered Wilder's orbit when she started dating his childhood friend and bandmate Matt Campbell. As King and Campbell's relationship went south, King and Wilder hit it off. He would have fights with her, Wilder recalls. After one of those fights, we ended up in a closet making love. King showed Wilder her headshots. Wilder offered to give King singing lessons. They became an item on and off and shared an apartment for a period of time, according to Wilder, who still has photos of his former sweetheart. I used to have one of her holding my Hamlet skull, he says, which she thought was maybe a good picture. King frequented Berlin Bratz performances. In the summer of 1977, as Wilder was falling under the spell of punk rock and Mullen was getting his new rehearsal space off the ground, the Bratz rented a room, becoming one of the earliest bands to inhabit the basement, alongside Backstage Pass, the Controllers, and the Skulls, some of whose members went on to form Wall of Voodoo, which scored an early MTV hit with the 1982 single Mexican Radio. King was a regular at the Bratz practices, hanging around and sipping Rainer ale through a straw. She was a sweet-natured, goofily naive Stevie Nicks fan, Mullen would later recall, who danced around her apartment to Rhiannon rather than the Sex Pistols or Ramones. King worked in a clothing shop on Sunset Boulevard while pursuing her Hollywood aspirations. Her sister told me she appeared briefly as part of a photographic montage in the opening credits of Richard Brooks' Looking for Mr. Goodbar, starring Diane Keaton and Richard Gere, a 1977 crime drama that would garner 2 Oscar nominations. The film, inspired by the 1973 murder of a New York City schoolteacher, premiered just weeks before King's disappearance. She wanted to be famous, says Wilder. To some of the mask, more bedraggled patrons, King seemed out of their league. She looked a little out of place, says Johnny Stingray, guitarist for the Controllers. I was a little too shy to say anything to her. Skulls frontman Stephen Fortuna, also known as Billy Bones, remembers King as a more conventionally fashionable figure than the rest of the mask crowd. She always had style, he says, just a really nice person. Liz Winchell first encountered King at Wilder's Hollywood Party Pad on the corner of Franklin and Whitley in a 1920s building designed by the same architects responsible for the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. I remember the day I met her, says Winchell, whose grandfather was the legendary gossip columnist Walter Winchell. We were playing the Stones, and that's what she and I first started talking about. We both loved the music. She was not a typical punk girl at all. She was very beautiful and put together in a way that we were not. She was on a different level. Winchell and King would go shopping together on Hollywood Boulevard and run around looking to score Quaaludes. I just remember her being really kind to me, says Winchell, now a licensed marriage and family therapist. And because I was younger, it was like she didn't have to be kind. She didn't have to take me under her wing. In some way, I looked up to her. By the fall of 1977, King had moved into the apartment in West Hollywood, which she shared with an architect named Stephen Moskowitz, whom she'd met through a roommate service. King remained close with Wilder, but she was going out with someone else, a chauffeur named Steve Rockney. On Monday, October 31st, Mullen had booked the Berlin Bratz for a show billed as an anti-disco Halloween. King asked Rockney if he wanted to accompany her, but he said he'd meet up afterward. The Berlin Bratz didn't end up playing, and when King arrived, she found the place more sparsely attended than usual. She stayed for a couple of hours and left the mask around 10 to call Rockney for a ride back to his place. Wilder couldn't have known it at the time, but he would never see her again. After King's missing persons report was filed on November 12th, Abra King started calling her daughter's friends. Were they with Jane? Had they seen her? Did they have any idea at all where she might be? That was the minute I knew she was gone, Wilder recalls of his conversation with Abra. I had a sixth sense. Winchell, who was living with her mother at the time, came home after being away for a couple of nights. Winchell's mother burst out crying and pulled her daughter close. "Were you with Jane today?" she wailed. "Where's Jane?" Winchell listened as her mother called Abra King. "I'll never forget hearing my mom talk to her mom after she told her I was home," Winchell recalled, choking up. "I remember them crying so hard together. I remember her saying what it must be like to be Jane's mom right now. I felt guilty. It could have been me." By the morning of Thursday, November 24th, King's whereabouts ceased to be a mystery. An article in the L.A. Times reported that the Hillside Strangler Task Force, created 2 days earlier, had identified her as the seventh body found since October 15th in a six-mile radius, including Glendale, Highland Park, La Crescenta, Griffith Park, and Elysian Park. When Wilder learned about King's murder on the news, it was too much for him. "I just didn't want to even think about it," he says. "She was so harmless and so sweet." As the number of murders ticked up, investigators developed a theory that there was not one killer, but two, luring victims by posing as police. The suspected duo claimed another two lives in the coming weeks. First, police found the body of 18-year-old college student Lauren Wagner on November 29th in the hills around Mount Washington. She'd been abducted the previous night, just steps from the house where she lived with her parents. Then, on December 14th, after 17-year-old sex worker Kimberly Martin was reported missing by a call girl agency she had joined, her body was found on a hillside within view of Los Angeles City Hall. Prostitutes on Sunset Boulevard and suburban mothers in Southern California, the New York Times reported, are sharing something this Christmas season: fear of a multiple murderer. Firearms sales ticked up. Self-defense classes sold out. Streetwalkers clustered in groups of six or more. The Strangler case makes a grim fact vividly clear, said a young Geraldo Rivera, reporting for ABC News. "People can never totally protect themselves from a madman who apparently chooses his victims at random." The sheer number of women who populated the mask helped define it as a scene. For some, Rivera's observation was all too real. A number of them would soon move into an apartment complex up the street called the Canterbury, which was essentially becoming a dormitory for punks. It stood just a few doors from one of the last known residences of Elizabeth Short, better known as the Black Dahlia. These were bold young women who played in bands and published zines and obliterated any notion of punk as a boys' club. But they were nonetheless vulnerable, and King's death brought the Strangler case close to home. "I remember how horrifying it was when we found out she'd been murdered," says Pleasant Gaiman, who went on to become an accomplished writer, burlesque performer, and singer of the Screamin' Sirens. "We had never known anyone that was murdered. That was something you read in a newspaper." One night, after leaving the Whiskey without a walking companion, Gaiman was apprehended by two cops, actual cops, thankfully, who searched her leather jacket and demanded to know why she was carrying a switchblade. "I just looked at them and I was like, 'The Hillside Strangler.'" Alice Bagg, also known as Alicia Armendariz, frontwoman of the Bags, got an eerie feeling about an incident relayed to her by a friend earlier that fall. Her friend, nicknamed Pearl Harbor, had been walking near the Whiskey in October when two men claiming to be cops stopped her. They put Pearl in the back of a car and drove her around, just abusing her, telling her she's a whore, she's disgusting, threatening her, recalls Armendariz, now a retired teacher who still has an active music career. "To this day, I believe Pearl had an experience with the Hillside Stranglers and that she lived to tell the tale. Pearl died several years ago." Writing about the murders around the 30th anniversary of the first killing, the photographer and former mask-goer Teresa Karakis observed, "The Hillside Strangler provided the tense undercurrent during this character-building period of L.A. punk rock. Punk rock girls stood up in defiance about being paranoid and went out anyway, dressed the way they wanted to, not so much to spit in the face of authority, but to assert themselves and claim responsibility for their actions. King's murder weighed heavily on Mullen. How would anybody be able to hear anything, he worried. A girl screams if somebody was strangling her in one of the many dark corners at the mask. Mullen hired a 350-pound, 6'4", uniformed security guard nicknamed Tiny to keep antenna out for sickos and to walk girls to their cars. Detectives interviewed people who knew King from the mask, where the band F-Word began to perform a song that would become its anthem, Hillside Strangler. During a meeting in his office at the bottom of the basement stairs, Mullen gave the task force what little information I could. Mullen would soon have a different sort of encounter with the law. He had obtained a police permit for cafe entertainment shows at the Mask, which was drawing ever bigger crowds as punk's siren call blared across the Los Angeles sprawl. What Mullen didn't possess were occupancy permits. The oversight caught up with him on January 17, 1978, when the Los Angeles Fire Department ordered the Mask to stop operating as a live music venue, at least until Mullen addressed a list of issues such as poor ventilation and a lack of sufficient egress. Owner Brendan Mullen says to bring the theater up to specifications would require expensive changes, including soundproofing and rewiring, the LA Times reported. 1 month later, a few days before a 20-band Save the Mask benefit at the Elks Lodge No. 99 near MacArthur Park, a 10th name was added to the death toll. Police found 20-year-old Silver Lake resident Cindy Hudspeth on February 17th in the trunk of her orange Datsun, which had tumbled 50 feet down an embankment off the Los Angeles Crest Highway. "We can see she is a strangler victim," an investigator told the press. After that, something unexpected happened. March came and went without another body, then April, then May. As the year drew to a close, police had yet to encounter another murder that fit the profile. Had something spooked the killers? Were they simply biding their time before striking again? The Hillside Strangler Task Force still didn't have any suspects. It was beginning to look as though they might never figure out who was behind the slayings. Then they got a phone call. In January 1979, the police chief of Bellingham, Washington, a waterfront city 21 miles south of the Canadian border, contacted the task force with some crucial information. The bodies of two young women, Karen Mandick and Diane Wilder, had been found in the trunk of Mandick's car, deep ligature marks around their necks. Police already had a suspect in custody. He'd been a security guard at the grocery store where Mandick worked, and he'd offered the women $100 each for a supposed house-sitting job from which they'd never returned. Notably, he'd lived in Los Angeles until the previous year. The suspect's name was Kenneth Bianchi, a handsome and charismatic 27-year-old, originally from Rochester, New York, where he'd been born to a 17-year-old alcoholic sex worker and raised by adoptive working-class Italian Catholics. A variety of behavioral issues were evident from a young age: compulsive lying, incontinence, passive-aggressive personality disorder, and poor academic performance, belied by above-average intelligence. After high school, he'd bounced around between menial jobs while trying unsuccessfully to break into law enforcement. With no career prospects and a history of petty theft, Bianchi had sought a new beginning in the mid-70s in Los Angeles, where he used fake credentials to pose as a psychologist and began relationships with two women. One of them became pregnant with Bianchi's son, but spurned his marriage proposal and moved north to be near her family in Bellingham, which is what brought Bianchi there in 1978. After learning about Bianchi from his counterparts in Washington State, Dudley Varney picked up the phone and called his boss. "We're going to Bellingham," he said. Connections to the L.A. victims became apparent. Bianchi had lived for 6 months in the same Glendale apartment complex as Christina Weckler. He'd also lived at 1950 Tamarind Avenue, the apartment complex to which Kimberly Martin had been dispatched by her call girl agency. Around the corner stood the bus stop where King had waited after her acting class. Members of the task force took Bianchi's fingerprints. Back in L.A., Varney was waiting for an elevator when a colleague bounded up to him with the news that they'd matched the prints to one of their crime scenes. "We got him." As Varney suspected, Bianchi had not been working alone during the killing spree. He confessed he'd committed the crimes with his adoptive older cousin, Angelo Buono, a minor crook with a record of abusive behavior toward women who ran a car upholstery business in Glendale. To nail Buono, prosecutors offered Bianchi life with the possibility of parole, no death penalty. He agreed to testify against his cousin, who maintained he was innocent and that Bianchi was a pathological liar. Evidence gathered by detectives suggested otherwise. They found fibers on two victims that matched those in Buono's home. Interrogations of Bianchi unspool the stories of 10 young women in and around L.A. who shared the misfortune of encountering a pair of twisted men between October 1977 and February 1978. It turned out there'd almost been 11. Posing as undercover vice cops, Bianchi and Buono had stopped Catherine Laurie one evening near the former Max Factor building just off Hollywood Boulevard. Bianchi aborted the plan after rifling through his intended target's wallet and realizing she was the daughter of the late actor Peter Laurie, who himself played a serial killer in Fritz Lang's M. "I had two photographs depicting my father and myself together," Laurie later testified, recalling that one of her would-be captors had remarked, "Hey, this really is Peter Laurie's kid." Buono wasn't wrong in depicting his cousin as a liar who couldn't be trusted. Bianchi had led a double life, after all. He'd even conjured supposed alternate personalities during his psychiatric evaluations. It's impossible to know how honestly Bianchi described each victim's abduction, rape, and murder. He would later claim to have invented details under pressure from interrogators. But his accounts are the closest we have to the truth about how these young women came to lose their lives. In King's case, the story Bianchi initially told goes like this. He and Buono were joyriding in Bianchi's 1972 Cadillac when they saw King, solitary and stunning in her shiny silver heels, at the bus stop on Franklin Avenue. They pulled into the parking lot of the Mayfair supermarket. Bianchi exited the car, walked over to the bus stop, and struck up a conversation. He and King were chatting when Bianchi feigned surprise at spotting his cousin, as if he just happened to be driving by. He waved at the car as Buono slowed down with a friendly honk and pressed on the brakes. Did King need a lift home? It was no trouble at all, they said. For reassurance, Bianchi flashed a fake badge and told her they were members of the L.A. Police Reserve. He opened the front passenger side door, and against her better judgment, King stepped in. The Cadillac cruised west on Franklin, past the Scientology Center, past Wilder's apartment, before pulling into a Hughes Market on the corner of Highland. King waited in the car while Bianchi and Buono went inside to buy cigarettes. When they returned, Bianchi told King that Buono was in a hurry to get home. Would she mind if they dropped him off first? And then Bianchi could take Buono's car and drive King back to her place. Not at all, King replied. They drove up Highland Avenue, and then Barham Boulevard, and east onto Forest Lawn Drive, before catching the freeway. King looked straight ahead as the Cadillac came to a stop in the driveway of Buono's yellow bungalow in Glendale. Everything happened so fast. Bianchi and Buono grabbed King's arms. She struggled to break free, They slapped handcuffs on her wrist and forced her into the house. The scene that unfolded from there is too graphic for these pages, but it ended with twine around King's neck and the life leaving her body. As King's roommate had said, she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Buono's murder trial, the longest in American history, began in November 1981. 2 years later, on October 31, 1983, the bailiff announced that the jury had reached its first of 10 verdicts. Roger Boren, the lead prosecutor in the case, felt his heart pounding as he awaited the jury's decision. He breathed a sigh of relief upon hearing the crucial word, guilty. It was like heaven opening when that first verdict came in, Boren recalls. In the coming days, Buono was convicted of all but one of the killings. We, the jury, the foreman declared on November 10th, find the defendant, Angelo Buono, guilty of the murder of Jane King. A reporter informed Abra King of the outcome. I got to the point where I didn't care, she said through tears. The thing you care about is losing your daughter. On November 18th, Buono, aged 49, was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. According to a reporter in the courtroom, he stared straight ahead and swallowed hard, but took the verdict with no other show of emotion. Bianchi is serving out his life sentence at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. He was denied parole in 2010 and will be eligible to apply again in 2025 at the age of 74. Buono died of natural causes in 2002 at the age of 67, alone in his cell at California's state prison at Calipatria. The following year, fronting a new lineup of the Skulls, Billy Bones recorded a song in memory of his former acquaintance. Jane hitched a ride on the Hollywood Stars one night, up to the hillside. That's where they took her life. Glad he now lies in his own deathbed. Yeah, yeah, the Hillside Strangler's dead. After his run-in with the fire department in January 1978, Mullen found creative ways to circumvent the show stoppage at the Mask, like acquiring a film permit for a TV crew to tape a performance, or hosting quasi-legal word-of-mouth parties where bands would just happen to play. At one such shindig in May 1978, the Go-Go's made their world debut, opening for the Weirdos and the Germs. Everybody in the scene was at that show, recalls Carlisle. We played a song called Overrun twice, and we played a song called Robert Hilburn. He was the music critic at the L.A. Times. That was our set list. With the scene rallying around him, Mullen tried to raise money to bring the Mask up to code. But the modest funds he amassed from benefit shows got eaten up by legal cost, and discussions with potential investors didn't pan out. For a brief stretch, Mullen operated a space on Santa Monica Boulevard called The Other Mask, which overlapped with his stealth gigs at the original Mask. The final nail in the coffin came on July 13, 1979. That night, Rick Wilder had put together a party with several bands, including Wilder's new act, the Mau Maus, a pre-Henry Rollins Black Flag, and a group called the Blackhearts, members of which would go on to perform under the same name as the backing band for Joan Jett, herself a scene fixture. Not long before the Mau Maus were set to take the stage, a fire marshal entered the basement with members of the LAPD. This time, 2 years after first opening its doors, Mullen accepted the venue's fate. The Mask may have come to an end, but as Mullen later put it, the new indigenous punk spirit was already too rooted, too strong, to just go away. L.A. punk had snowballed into a force the Tin Mask couldn't contain. Bands could now sell out traditional venues like the Whiskey. The scene was spreading to new stomping grounds, places like the Hong Kong Cafe in Chinatown, Club 88 on Pico Boulevard, and the Fleetwood in Redondo Beach. For some bands, the road ahead was paved with record deals, world tours, and MTV. By 1980, as the L.A. Times suggested, Ponca turned Los Angeles into arguably the most exciting live music center in America. Mullen went on to enjoy a fruitful career as a show promoter, music journalist, and author. His works include 2001's We Got the Neutron Bomb, an oral history of L.A. punk, co-authored with Mark Spitz, and Live at the Mask, Nightmare in Punk Alley, a 2007 coffee table book. In 2009, Mullen was working on a book with the Red Hot Chili Peppers when he died from a stroke, suffered the day after celebrating his 60th birthday with his longtime partner, writer, and researcher, Kateri Butler. In a New York Times obituary that heralded Mullen as a pillar of Los Angeles punk, Ben Cesario wrote, "Although the Los Angeles punk scene has generally been less celebrated than those of London or New York, it was extensive. With the Mask as their incubator, the city's bands began to develop a distinct style that reflected the disaffection of young people in a sprawling, glittery megalopolis. In November, I made a pilgrimage to the Mask, which is now used for storage and video shoots by World of Wonder Productions, the company behind RuPaul's Drag Race, headquartered in the building above." World of Wonder co-founder Randy Barbato, who knew Mullen coincidentally, took me down to the legendary basement to have a look around. I brought along three esteemed tour guides from the Mask heyday, Pleasant Gaiman, K.K. Barrett, and Trudy Argelis Barrett, famously christened L.A.'s most popular punk in a 1978 issue of New York Rocker. As we pored over ancient graffiti that still decorates the walls, Barrett pointed to a name scrawled on a yellow beam in thick black marker, Rick Wilder. "He never became as well known as some of the other Mask alumni, but he's an underground legend nonetheless. Fans of The Weeknd will recognize Wilder as a haunting figure who appears in three of the Grammy-winning pop star's music videos." In a cruel and eerie twist, King was not Wilder's only former girlfriend to fall prey to a serial killer. In the early 90s, while living in Manhattan at the storied Whitby Apartments on West 45th Street, Wilder dated a young woman named Tiffany Bresciani. Like King, Bresciani was an aspiring actor who'd found her way into the punk scene. Her relationship with Wilder deteriorated, and Bresciani spiraled into heroin addiction and prostitution, a path that ended in 1993 when she became the 17th and final victim of Joel Rifkin. "She didn't deserve any of that," Wilder laments. "Wilder told me King was his first love. I thought of her when I was down in the Mask, where King had watched Wilder perform 46 years earlier. You might say King's story echoes that of the Black Dahlia. Two striking young women trying to make it in Hollywood, who ended up brutally murdered by elusive killers, their bodies left nude and desecrated for strangers to find. The difference is that Elizabeth Short became famous in death, while King was essentially forgotten to time." At the Mask, King inhabited the same social space as people who would become stars, some in the most conventional sense of the word, others in their capacity as subcultural icons. Whether King herself actually had a chance of making it is beside the point. The killers took more than her life. They took her dreams. Right before our visit to the Mask, Gaiman and I strolled past the old Chateau Elysee and stood for a few minutes at the bus stop where King disappeared. Gaiman, whose apartment is a short walk from there, mused thoughtfully about the paradox of Hollywood. "It's a sparkly wonderland of ambition, bright and sunny and beautiful, but its sinister underbelly is always just a tragedy away. King may not have attained the fame she sought in life, but in death she became a part of this haunted legacy." Standing beside the bus stop, Gaiman turned to me and said, "There's something about Hollywood that people who aren't from Los Angeles don't understand. The energy here is so hopeful, but also so doomed."
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the Proust Questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Melissa Etheridge, the musician and author of the new memoir, Talking to My Angels, on Pancakes, Patrick Mahomes, and the Power of Attention. What is your favorite occupation? Rock star. When and where were you happiest? When I'm in the middle of my family and we're all laughing, a very close second is when I'm on stage. What is your greatest extravagance? Having my hairdresser come out to my home to cut and color my hair and my whole family's hair. I haven't been to a salon in years. What is your greatest fear? To let fear overcome my life. We're not going to let that happen because love is always greater than fear. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Deplore is a heavy word. I don't deplore it, but I constantly feel the pull of my old Midwestern ways of eating. Boy, can I put some pancakes away. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Journey and path. And I'm sure I will use it a few more times in this. Which talent would you most like to have? Athletic talent. I have none. On what occasion do you lie? I gave up lying at least 15 years ago. The truth is always, 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 no exception, better for your health and for the world. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I gave up on that, too. I gave up disliking my appearance, because that's crazy-making, especially in women. I love my appearance. What is your greatest regret? Bruce Springsteen's record company asked my record company if they could put our duet of Thunder Road on the B-side of his single Secret Garden. Island Records was mad at Sony, so they asked me not to say yes. It was a silly business thing that they were having, and I missed the opportunity to put that out into the world. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Again, not going to change anything about myself. I've really learned to appreciate everything. Okay, maybe I'd be taller. How about that? Which living person do you most despise? I'm not a despising person. I do not give my attention or my energy to people who are outside of my vibrational understanding. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A wide receiver that catches passes from Patrick Mahomes. What is your most treasured possession? My earlier guitars and a harmonica Springsteen gave me on my birthday. It's silver-plated from Tiffany that he got engraved. Who are your favorite writers? Jeanette Winterson, Virginia Woolf, and Alice Walker. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Orlando, male, female, everything. Who are your heroes in real life? My stagehands, my roadies, my technicians that set up and tear down my show every single night. What is your favorite journey? I'm on it right now, this journey of life. This is the stuff, man. This is it. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Elizabeth, with Melissa Etheridge. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.